Okay, so sliding into spring break, getting close. We did finish grading your exam one, and I have them here, and we'll turn them back to you at the end of class. The solutions I put on the web today, and the grade distribution is on the web as well. The mean grade was basically 80 to 84, depending exactly on how I calculated it. The 80 is if I take the full distribution and just take the average. The 84 is if I take what's basically the distribution, the core distribution, and ask for its mean. You should look over your exam carefully, and if you have any questions or issues with the grading, basically bring them up with me. Mistakes do get made. If there's something you don't understand after looking over the solution, that's fine. I was trying to de-emphasize the quantitative aspects in some sense for this class, so there was a bit more of multiple choice, short answer stuff that's easy to grade, but is also a little bit merciless in terms of partial credit. So typically in physics, what we'll do is with the nice big long analytical problems, you can give a lot of partial credit because you can see what the student understands and what they don't, and you can tend to, not all misunderstandings are equal. So you can try to make some judgments about the gray area. So one of the problems with giving a test like I did to you guys is that you sort of lose that. That said, look over. If you have any questions, let me know. Sometimes mistakes do happen, even to the point of just adding up the grades wrong. So if you find a problem, just bring it to my attention, and we'll see what we can do. When you look at it, basically, I think everybody did pretty well. There are a handful of you that didn't do as well as you probably would have liked. And so I am trying to de-emphasize the extent to which the exams really count in the class. So in that sense, if you are engaged in the class and going to recitation and reading the stuff and sort of participating, then you're going to do okay. It'd be nice if the exam grades sort of also confirmed that. So if you find that your exam grades are not as good as you would like, if you're not going to recitation, you should start going because that's where you can get in trouble in this class, is if in fact you're not actually engaging in the class. I'm not expecting everything to make a lot of sense. And I tried to put some pretty straightforward stuff on the test. I also put some stuff that was a little bit subtle. But I guess that's my advice. If the exam grade wasn't where you would like it to be, the first thing to do is to make sure that you're doing recitation and doing the reading and stuff. And then ask yourself if there's anything that might have indicated why, because I have in the syllabus, I have it set up so you do have an exam drop, but if you found, for example, that you stayed up all night the night before and therefore weren't thinking at all when you took the test, clearly next time you want to make sure you get a good night's sleep and then you'll do better. So, and if you're finding that you're confused about some things and need to study a couple of days earlier and find time to ask questions, then you want to do that. So, anyway, now's the time to think about it if you find you didn't do as well as you would like. The grades are in Blackboard. Hopefully you can actually see them. And I've asked the TAs to put recitation attendance and scores also, which probably isn't up yet. I don't think they had anything on there as of this morning, but I hope within a couple of days that'll be there. Any questions about this? Okay, so last time we started to get into probably what is some of the weirdest stuff that science has uncovered in quantum mechanics. And remember, the idea of quantum mechanics comes in when you get this confusion between waves and particles. So the mechanics that Newton invented basically is treating particles as little masses, little point masses. And waves are sort of a diffuse thing. The waves are not like particles. They don't have mass. They're sort of this coherent relationship of motion between objects in a medium. That's sort of the picture you use. Or in the case of the electromagnetic field, it's this coherence in the electric and magnetic field oscillations from point to point in space, but it's not, they don't have mass. Now, the minute that you say that you want to consider the wave properties of particles that have mass, the mathematics becomes actually different, and people had to invent a new way of dealing with this, which is what we formally call quantum mechanics. And the quantum mechanics has a few very bizarre aspects to it, which I'm going to paint for you today. One of the important things that comes out of quantum mechanics is it cannot give you exact predictions in terms of particular events and exactly how they'll turn out. What quantum mechanics can give you is a probability distribution for how a distribution of things would turn out. So if an electron is coming through a slit, because it's a wave, if the slit is narrow enough, in fact, it will act like a wave, and you can think of the electron as diffracting here. So what that means is if it were just like a particle, the electron would go through here, and what you would get when it hits a detector over here would be a very sharp distribution. It would be like you had a flashlight right here and you had a screen with a hole. What you would see is just a sharp outline of that hole. That's what you would expect if the particle was just like a particle. But since it's like a wave, what happens is that you get this thing diffracts. So that means that there is non-zero probability of actually getting the particle to be out here, which would be in the shadow if it were just going straight. And so if in fact you use laser light in a very thin slit, and we've done that in a demo, what we found was that we got a stripe of light which was sort of bright in the middle, and that was the diffraction, the diffractive light. You get the same thing with the electrons. So if you send a million electrons through this slit, what you will get is a distribution in how the electrons arrange themselves on this detector on the far side. And that distribution will have more of them in the middle and few out here, but you will have some out here. And if I were to plot the probability of seeing these electrons, as where the probability goes this way, and it's this red curve, you would see most of them directly beneath this slit, and then they would fall off with diminishing probability as you go off to the side. But there'd be non-zero probability of actually getting it way out here. Yes?
Does a single electron still
function as a wave? So that's where we're headed right now. So then the question is exactly that. What happens with a single electron? And in fact, what I was really just describing was a million single electrons going through, not all at once. I mean, you could imagine sending them all at once, you'd actually end up with the same sort of picture. But if you sent them one at a time, let's now simplify and say, okay, let's just think of one of them. What happens if you have just one going through? And when you do the quantum mechanical calculation, all you get out is the fact that it should be distributed in terms of its probability like this. And that's all it tells you. Which means if you're dealing with one event, what happens? And basically, it can be anywhere along here because there is a finite possibility that it happens anywhere here. And you have no way of knowing whether it will happen or not. over here or there or there. There's no information at all in the calculation. So that's a little bit weird. I have a little analogy that I use. I don't actually remember whether I use this in the book or not, but if I do, sorry for the repetition. I mean, suppose you decided you would have a party every week, you know, some Thursday night party, right? And you invite a friend, and your friend says, you know, I might show up, I might not. There'll be about a 20% probability I'll show up. Well, that means, just based on information, right, you have no idea if they'll show up or not that night, right? All you know is that if you throw 100 parties, 100 weeks, and you keep track, they will have shown up about 20 times randomly throughout that. That's all you know. So it's a very different sort of thing. There's no deterministic piece there. I mean, it's like having very confused or uncertain friends. So it's not to say it's useless, right? If you had 100 friends and they all gave you that answer, you could gamble every day, every time you threw a party, on about 20 of them showing up. And you'd be more or less okay. Sometimes you'd have 25, sometimes 28, sometimes 15. But you'd be about right in planning, you know, all the iced tea that you wanted to bring or whatever it is. So it's a little bit different. But quantum mechanics gives you very clean calculation for the probability, but it now cannot tell you anything about the individual particles, really, other than the probability distribution. So in the calculation, there is a quantity called the wave function, and it turns out that the square of the wave function is the quantity that is this probability distribution. And here's the guy who gave us that. I guess I showed you that last time. Okay, so in the single particle, then, what do we know? We know that as we send it through the slit, it has this kind of probability distribution as to where it will show up, and you do not know where it will show up. And in terms of trying to picture what's going on as this electron proceeds from the slit all the way to this detector, how do we describe it? In quantum mechanics, we describe this electron through this so-called wave function, which basically the square of the wave function will give the probability of that electron being at a certain point as a function of where it is in space and time. Okay? So that means that the quantum mechanical wave function has to have within it basically a description of this shape. Since the square of the wave function has to basically give you this shape, I mean, you can sort of think of this as a bit of a visualization of what that wave function looks like. So the mathematics that describes this electron has to be extended in space all the way up until the very instant that that electron is detected. The moment that electron is detected, which could be here, could be there, could be here, could be there, or it could be right here. Let us suppose that it is detected right here. Mathematically, in the theory, at that very instant, you go from having no direct knowledge of exactly where this thing is to having precise and absolute knowledge of exactly where it is. And that happens instantly. So if you look at what happens in the mathematics, as the electron is going from here all the way to just before it hits there, you have the wave function being this diffuse thing that allows the electron to interact anywhere in here, and you don't know where it's going to be. And then the next instant, what you have is a probability distribution that is a spike at the one point where it was, because you know exactly where that electron interacted. And this is really bothersome, because it happens instantaneously. So if you're trying to get your head around what physically is going on, people call this a wave function collapse. It's an instantaneous collapse of this description to that description. And that should bother you because, in a sense, how does the wave function over here know that it should no longer be there in an instant? Right? There's not even time for light to travel. Now, energy isn't moving from one place to another, so you don't run into troubles with relativity, but it's sort of a causality thing. I mean, because you don't interact until you interact, and how does everywhere know that you interacted if you haven't had a chance for light to travel from one point to another to tell them? So it's very strange business. So I've got a couple of examples to paint. Now I've got a few examples here. Things get a little bit weirder than this. This is a single particle thing. All right. Let us do something slightly different. If you recall, at one point we looked at a double slit interference pattern, and the idea with the double slit interference is you have a light and the light shines on the two slits. And when the light shines on the two slits, each slit, you get diffraction. And in some places, the wave from this slit and the wave from that slit add constructively, so they add together. And in other places, it's destructively. So what happens if I have a screen over here? And I were to, if I look at the intensity, then because of this constructive and destructive interference, what you end up seeing are sort of bright fringes. So I don't know if this makes any sense to you, but when it's like this, I mean it's bright, and when it's here, it's like dim. So the intensity of the light is sort of going this way. So you'd have a bright fringe, a bright fringe, a bright fringe, a bright fringe, a bright fringe. So a way to think about it is if I have the light shining through the slit, and you were looking at what you would see on the screen, you would see something like something like this. That would be with your eye looking at the screen, okay? If it were not a wave, the light is shining through these two holes, you would expect to just see basically two illuminated slits, or the shadow around two slits. You okay with that? All right. So what will happen if I send a beam of electrons through a double slit? What would you expect to see? What do you think?
Some of it would cancel out, and some of it would be like, you know, have the waves twice the amplitude.
Okay, so you would expect the within this beam of electrons, it would act like waves, so you would get diffraction here and diffraction here, and then you get constructive and destructive interference, which would manifest itself on the screen or in your detector basically in exactly this way. Are you okay with that? Because all we're doing is electrons instead of light, but it's the same thing. Okay. Now, suppose we have just a single electron. What do you think you're going to see?
You mean if you send a single electron just through one of the holes, or just towards...
I'm sending a single electron toward this double slit pattern.
I think there wouldn't be diffraction because it would have to go through just one of the holes, so then it would look like the first model that you showed us, where there's like a peak in the light, but it would land.
Okay.
Also, could it just like light in the middle?
No, that's not stupid. That, in fact, I mean, we're going to see both of these, actually, but let me, yeah.
Well, it would be just a joint probability of, you know, like the two, except for probably, you know, separate probabilities of normal distributions.
Okay. So you've hit them all, I think. And now what you exactly see sort of, it depends. So let's talk about, because it's really weird. I think, naively, I would always say that, which is, it's a particle, so it's got to go through this one or that one, which means I'm going to basically see a shadow of this slit or that slit. That'd be sort of what I would naively think. But that is a classical point of view where you're looking at the particle as a particle. It's a wave, and so by virtue of it being a wave, it can't really go through this one or that one. It has to go through both. Which means it diffracts as if it were a wave, as weird as that sounds. So long as you think of it as this unresolved wave, it has to have a non-zero probability of going through each of them because it has spatial extent, and then it will interfere with itself on the other side, and in fact, you will get an interference pattern, but it's a weird interference pattern because all you've got is this one electron, and so it's got to hit the screen somewhere. It cannot hit the screen in all of these places at once, right? Actually, light can't do it either, so what I'm saying about the electron is also true for light, for photons, okay, the particle nature of photons. So what do you actually see? What you end up with is if you send one electron, what I'm going to do now is draw on the screen as if you were looking at it what you would see. And it's going to be a dot will be what the electron does. So you send one electron through, you'll get a dot somewhere on the screen. So that doesn't tell you very much. Now send another electron through, another dot. Another electron through, another dot. Another one, another dot. Keep doing this one at a time, independently, and what you will slowly see as a function of time as these things add is something that in time you get these single dots that as time goes by and you integrate more of them, you actually end up with being able to see this double slit interference pattern. In other words, each electron goes through and interacts someplace, but it interacts with a probability that is governed by this double slit interference thing. Okay? Which means the wave function comes through, its probability distribution now changes to where you're most likely to find the electron in one of these bright slits. So it actually changes. I mean, so even a single electron can interfere with itself. So that's major evidence that the electron is a wave, right? That it has extent over both of these two slits. So you okay with that? All right. Now I want to do the same experiment with a small change. Now what I want to do is to put a couple of little metal plates here connected subtly across some voltage detector, which basically, after the electron goes through the slits, I put a little detector, I call it a non-destructive detector, something that doesn't actually ruin the electron, but it can tell you whether the electron went through the lower slit or the upper slit. Okay? If I have this device here and it is not functioning, then I see exactly what we saw on the last slide. The moment that I turn this device on, this pattern turns into something that's more like this. In other words, it's as if you're no longer interfering. Because if I send a single electron through and it doesn't act like a wave and doesn't interfere with itself, then it's either going to go through this one or through that one, and I'll get sort of this double hump structure. In your textbook, the way the diffraction is broad, and so the way they two of them add up is one smooth distribution here, which I think was one of you said was you get something in the middle. It would actually look like it's in the middle. So whether you get the two humps or one smooth distribution here is depends really on the slit width here and separation. Yeah?
I'm kind of confused about how a single electron would still cause diffraction.
Right. That's because in your mind you think of it as a point-like thing, but when we say it's a wave, it's not point-like anymore. So when it hits, it has to hit both slits, and then when it does, just like the water wave hitting both slits, it sort of turns into two sources and it interferes with itself. And that's what the waves do. So when you say electron now, you also mean wave. And if that feels uncomfortable, I there's not a lot I can do to help, because it feels uncomfortable to everybody that I've ever met. I mean, it's truly weird stuff. Okay. But now, this is even weirder, because I have a wave, it goes through the two slits, it interferes with itself, and somewhere after it goes through a slit, I ask, which slit did it go through? Which is a particle-like question. If I have a device that gives me that information, it collapses the wave function to where it looks as if it were particles. In other words, it either hits here or here, and it no longer gives you that interference pattern as if it's a wave. If I have that device turned off, it goes back to the interference pattern. Yes.
Well, I guess my question would be, like, when you're using the baseball example to explain that it's a particle and a wave at the same time, there's a particle moving a wave-like function, then if I mean, like, you threw a baseball at the screen, it would separate into two different openings.
Right.
So why is an electron different, I guess?
That's a great question. These slits are narrow enough that the wave of the electron is sort of large on the scale of the slits. So if you calculate the wavelength of a baseball, it's so tiny I can't produce slits in the lab where I could make this happen with a baseball. But with electrons, we actually can. And or photons, we can.
So
yes?
The direction
like that. Well, so the electron is moving this way, so you can think of the wave as being sort of smeared out this way as it goes through the two slits, and then it diffracts and diffracts. And when you get the diffraction pattern on the screen, what you would see is a variation in intensity. If it were interfering with itself, that variation in intensity would look like that. Okay? So you can think of the wave moving this way. And here I sort of introduced this talking about light and photons because you've sort of seen that, and somehow it's a little easier maybe at this stage because we've been talking about light being a wave for so long, it's easier to accept. But the truth is, it's no different in the eyes of quantum mechanics. They both have wave and particle properties. Yes?
So, when you have like a single electron that interferes with itself, what happens to the mass of the electron?
It's all still there.
It's spread out.
It's just that the electron, when it reverts from its wave character to its particle character, which it does when it interacts with your detector, basically. It would interact with its normal electron mass. And so what happens is that if it's interfering with itself, it means you have this probability distribution so that if I were to send 1,000 of them through individually, you know, I would get this sort of probability distribution as to where they would interact. So in that sense, it gets spread out a bit by the process according to a probability distribution. But for every individual electron, it would look just like a single electron interacting. The only weird thing that you would get that would tell you that you have a wave instead of a particle is that you might get some interaction over here, whereas if it were a particle, you'd expect it to sort of just go straight through. If you did 1,000 of them, then you begin to really see it's a wave because you get this interference pattern. And now what I'm telling you is that you would naively believe that you're getting this pattern because the wave goes through the two slits and interferes with itself. And now what I'm telling you is, if I put a detector even after that slit, I can collapse the wave function from being one where it interferes with itself to one where it doesn't. Which is very strange. And it leads to a lot of discussion and confusion in quantum mechanics. So you will run into things about quantum mechanics that will tell you things such as the wave function doesn't collapse until I observe it, which is sort of what's happening when I put the detector there. And so the whole idea that the observer is now a critical part of the quantum process happening has gotten a lot of press. Okay? And there is some truth to it, I believe, because it is true. This experiment that I described, people have actually done. It does actually happen. So then the question is, what's really going on? Your detector may not destroy the electron, but there has to be some sort of detector-electron interaction, because otherwise you would never get a signal on your detector. So it could be as simple as I put a little metal plate here, and if the electron goes through the near slit, it will cause a little Coulomb force on this plate, which I can detect, that's greater than it would if it went through the far slit. Okay, so I'm not really touching the electron, but I do have a little bit of an interaction there. And it turns out that that interaction is enough to sort of change the quantum mechanical wave function in a strange sort of way. Or not in a strange way, but... I have drawings and things that lay this out more, so when I put the notes on the web, it'll contain more information. I don't want to take the time to draw or to write all this right now. So it appears that the act of observing can collapse the wave function. And so this is something that's very important, or there's been a lot of confusion about it. So let me give you a different example, which in fact was discussed in 1935 by Albert Einstein. and a guy named Podolsky and Rosen, and it's called the EPR paradox. So let us suppose that we have a particle which is called a pion, and there does exist a particle, it's called a pion, and the pion, a neutral pion, can actually decay into two photons, okay, and when it decays into them, they'll go back to back because they basically are conserving momentum. And so let us suppose we have a pion that decays into two photons, that are traveling back to back. Okay? We've talked about particles having spin already, which is, you can think of as like little bar magnet aspect to them. Turns out photons have spin too. And for now, all I want to do is consider it as a photons actually have a type of an orientation which we can measure. So it turns out that this quantity spin has to be conserved. It's a form of angular momentum, and I don't know if you have dig angular momentum very much, but if you watch the Olympics and you look at ice skaters or something, right? When they go into a spin, they're out like this, right? And they're spinning slowly. And then when they bring everything in like this, they start spinning faster and faster and faster, right? And this is something known as quantity of conservation of angular momentum. So just like you have in linear momentum, if you have something that's massive and going fast, it has a lot of momentum and it's hard to stop it. Okay? If you have something that has mass and speed and has its mass distributed far out in the spin, it's hard to stop the spin. But so there's a conservation. If you bring this in close, the mass is now at a closer radius, but the speed has to increase in order to conserve this strange quantity called angular momentum. So that's why the skaters bring their arms in, they're spinning very fast, and then when they want to stop, they do this, right? They fling everything out all at once, because that takes their mass, distributes it out, and it slows them down. Same thing is true for divers. If you've ever noticed, when they do a lot of somersaults, they get really tight in a tuck, and they get tight so they spin faster. So it's a weird sort of thing. Anyway, I'm sorry for the diversion. Photons have to do the same thing. What it means is if you start out with something that has zero spin, when these two photons are emitted, they either come out with a spin this way and that way, or like this. But you can't have this and you can't have that. Okay, so there are certain conservation laws that come into play. This may be, it doesn't matter, I could call it different things, but let us say that when these two photons come out, they either come out with their spins oriented like this, or like this. Now you may say, I don't know anything about spin. It doesn't really matter, that you don't need to understand about spin on this. What does happen though is that they're basically created together, okay? And this is a quantum mechanical process that happens, and as these two photons are created, you're either going to get this or you're going to get this. But if you calculate it, you don't know which you've got until you make until you detect one of the photons. You have a 50-50 probability of having this or this. Now, these photons are light. This can go 20 miles, right? These two photons can just go a long, long way. And then you can detect one. The moment you detect, say, a photon on one side, if you see this orientation, you know that the other one over on the other side has that orientation. You okay with that? If you see this orientation, you know the other one over here has that orientation. Okay? These are called entangled photons. What's weird is that until you make the measurement, it turns out that you still have a 50-50 probability of these things happening. And that 50-50 probability is maintained until you measure it. I make a measurement of one of these photons. How does that other photon, 40 miles away, know what orientation it's supposed to be? These experiments have been done. And sure enough, when you make that measurement, that photon 40 miles away knows which it's supposed to be. I hope that bothers you a little bit. Did you have a question?
Well, you said it, you don't know which one it is until you measure it. Does that mean it's not real to you? Like, I feel like...
Well, that's a...
You want it together before you measure it.
What has been established in the lab is that the 50-50 probability aspect of it is maintained all the way until you actually make that measurement. And the instant that measurement is made, the other one over here is totally determined. But that uncertainty exists up until this moment. And now there are two ways to look at it. Okay? One way to look at this is that you have an entangled wave function, so this probability distribution basically encompasses these two photons. They're tied together somehow in this probability distribution. That wave function is ill-determined. There's a 50-50 probability up until the moment you actually make a measurement, at which point this wave function totally collapses into either this or that. Okay, and you won't know which it is until this or that. That's one way to look at it, and mathematically that's okay, except for that very transition moment where there's no real understanding about that particular transition, and it's as if it breaks causality. It's as if it's as if the information travels faster than the speed of light. It's a very bizarre thing. Okay, there's another way to look at this. When the quantum mechanical process happens, there's one great wave function in the universe. And in this great wave function in the universe, it encompasses two pieces. In one piece, this happens. In the other piece, this happens. Okay? And in fact, within this great universe wave function, both things actually happen. You have one thread of the wave function of the greater universe where this happens, and you have one thread of this greater function in the universe where that happens. And in the mathematics that describes this overall wave function, everything proceeds very smoothly and is very happy. But if you happen to be in the thread where you see this, that's what you see. And if you happen to be in the thread where you see this, that's what you see. And the probability of one thread versus the other is 50-50. So if you step back and ask what I've just said, a way to think about it that is very popular is that at the moment this quantum process happens, our universe splits into two. In one universe, you see this. In the other universe, you see that. Now, it's completely understood why, when I detect this photon, I know what this one is. Because I'm in a universe where if I see this one like this, I see this one like that, because that's all that's there. If I'm in the other universe, if I see this one like this, I have to see that one like that, because that's all that's there. You don't have the weirdness of preserving this 50-50 probability and then having to collapse it at the moment you make a choice, because all the choices are made right at the start, and you actually just evolve different threads within the universe or within the greater universe. So you either throw out causality and have some weirdness that way, or you have multiple universes. Yes?
So don't they just start off as one or the other? Like, why does it have to be decided once you measure that the other one's going out?
No, because there are ways in the lab to show that you have this 50-50 uncertainty all the way. So at the decay, you have... You really do have this 50-50 uncertainty.
50-50 uncertainty that they're both going to face this way or both going to face this way.
Yes.
So if they're both facing this way or both facing this way, it doesn't make sense that once you measure this one, of course this one is going to be facing this way, because that's what you determine in the beginning?
You don't know until you actually look at it. So what you're saying is that at the very start you have this or that, but there's a 50-50 probability you have one or the other. You're basically sort of saying it's as if you make the observation right at the start. And I have to think a little bit. There are reasons why that uncertainty actually is, these really are entangled. That uncertainty is really real up until you make this observation way out here. And I'm not thinking of a good way to explain that right now. I'll have to come back to that, because I have to think about how best to explain that and understand that it's weird stuff. Again, I have some better notes, but these are called entangled photons. So there is an example that people use to talk about this difference between the ways of looking at things. The way of looking at this wave function as sort of proceeding until you make an observation when it collapses was actually... put forth primarily by Bohr, and it's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. This idea that at the moment of a quantum process that you have the universe splitting was put forth by Hugh Everett in 1957 as a PhD thesis. Now, Hugh actually took a lot of heat for this and ended up leaving physics in part because Bohr was the great old man who had invented, you know, the Bohr model and was very well known. And then Hugh Everett comes up and has this completely wacky idea of multiple universes, basically. And so it wasn't thought of that nicely, and it does have some problems, okay? Because it turns out there are legitimate quantum mechanical states that should exist, which are these mixed states. So there's I talked about this and that. You can sort of have a state which is half this and half that, that's fully legitimate in quantum mechanics, and you never really see such a thing like that. So there's an extreme example which sort of brings this to light, which is called Schrodinger's cat. And it's just a thought experiment to sort of bring out how crazy these ideas are. So in Schrodinger's cat example, you find a cat and you put it in a box, and what you have in the box is a radioactive nucleus that has a 50-50 probability of decaying within an hour, okay, after you start the timer. And if this nucleus decays, you have some sort of a detector that'll see the decay, and the moment it sees the decay, it drops a hammer on a bottle of poison, which kills the cat. Okay? If this doesn't decay, then the hammer doesn't drop. So when you put the cat in the box and close the box and you wait 1 hour, there's a 50-50 probability, totally governed by the quantum mechanics of this nucleus, that's going to decay. If it decays, the cat's dead. If it doesn't, the cat's fine. What do you see when you open the box? So if you were to try to analyze this with quantum mechanics, the thing is, when the box is closed, when you have not made an observation, all you know is probabilities. So the cat exists in a state which is half dead and half alive. And you collapse that the moment you look in and see that the cat is there, either alive or dead. So I hope that bothers you, but this is what quantum mechanics is telling you. I mean, this is the state of your knowledge of the quantum mechanical calculation, okay? That it is perfectly happy with this cat that's basically half dead and half alive, as strange as that may seem. Yes?
Just because we can't know the result doesn't mean that there isn't a certain probability. And just because we can't predict it also, again, doesn't mean there's a certain probability. There could be trends that, I don't know, that are beyond our, observation.
Well, okay, so people say that quantum mechanics is an imperfect theory, and if you really knew the real theory, it would be deterministic, and we wouldn't have this sort of weird problem of not knowing until we observe. But we've not been able to find such a theory. Okay, so quantum mechanics in and of itself can't tell you anymore. All you know is how to model the cat, during that period. Yes?
I don't understand why the cat is half dead and half alive instead of, it's either dead or alive, but we haven't checked on the cat yet.
Right. It's how do you model it? What does the quantum mechanics say? So if you say it's dead or alive, but we haven't checked on it yet, how do you get the probability of this thing happening right? Because this nucleus is governed by a quantum mechanical probability. Has it decayed or not? I don't know. The cat's tied in with whatever happens with this nucleus. This is a different one. I mean, it's some nuclei are just unstable, and they have what's called a half-life, and you can quantify it, and there exists nuclei that if I had a sample of 100 of them, half of them would decay within an hour. And so we're assuming that's one of those. Yes?
I mean, regardless of what this formula or whatever says, when you open that box, get them, you're alive then.
Yeah.
In all reality.
Right.
So wouldn't the probability just be, if you do this experiment 10 times, 5 of them, 5 of the cats are going to be dead and found or be alive?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just, so is it not so much that it's half dead, half alive, is that it's just a 50%?
Well, I think where what I'm getting to is, I mean, we have a theory that gives the right probability distribution, which is the quantum mechanics. So then look within the guts of the quantum mechanics and ask yourself, how is it getting this probability right? And for it to get it right, it has this weird interpretation of this cat wave function. And then either you collapse the wave function instantly when you open the box, so the observer basically collapses this weird case into either a dead or alive cat by the mere act of observing, or you live in a place where this quantum mechanical process basically splits the universe in two, and one of which the cat is alive and one of which it's dead, which is the many worlds way of looking at it. So there is a bit of a difference. I mean, I sense we're struggling with, well, duh, the cat's alive or dead after an hour, which is true. But what I'm trying to get you to look at is how are we modeling that? What is quantum mechanics really saying? What is the essence of the theoretical picture here? And when you look at that in detail, it's very bizarre, because you now have to mathematically get this right. In this case, it's not so terribly complicated. It's 50-50, cat's dead or alive. But quantum mechanics can model things that are enormously complex, that are very difficult. I mean, you could never have visualized, and it gets it right. So the mechanics of the theory, the same basic weirdness that I'm talking about with this half-dead, half-cat, half-alive cat, really works in a lot of cases where it's not, you know, so obvious what would happen. And when you now take that mechanics and you think about it in detail, you get this sort of strangeness. Yeah.
So what does this tell us? Is this, because we knew it was half, either, you know, 50-50. Like, is this, because life is, you know, just a number of probabilities regardless. Like, what does this add anything to our, you know, to what we already knew, or they're just manipulating probabilities to show the most likely path, you know, like that a sequence of events will follow? Because that's, you know, I don't know, that can be done with just using probabilities.
Yeah. So I mean, quantum mechanics gives you probabilistic distributions, no question about it. So then the question is, what's going on in reality? And in the one case, you have to preserve the mix of probabilities until the observation is made and you have the instantaneous collapse, Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. The problem with that is it involves this instantaneous collapse of something with large and finite spatial extent, which is bothersome. Okay, and that transition is pretty well ill-defined. I mean, how do you do that? The other picture, which mathematically works, is where you let it all evolve according to the probability distribution. You have sort of a large-scale wave function that allows all the possibilities to continue to evolve according to their probabilities. And basically, each of these pictures is then separated in the mathematical space in which you do this modeling, which is called Hilbert space. But each of these threads would constitute sort of a separate reality. So that's a very different way of sort of looking at it.
How can that be? Yeah, intuitively, it doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, is there some, you know, math that they made up to make it?
Well, the math works. The math totally works. So the math, I mean, imagine this. So the math would be, I have a wave function that has probability 1, okay, that something will happen. The cat is dead or alive. Within that, I have two pieces of it. The cat is dead, the cat is alive. And I allow these to continue with 50-50 probability within my larger wave function. So it all works out fine. These two are separated within the mathematics of the calculation as if they were different dimensions. And so then the trick is, okay, so you can't see each other, I mean, first of all, sort of, how are these realities separated? And then secondly, within the quantum mechanics, there is a legitimate state that you do not see, which is this half and half state. Why do we not see that? So at the time Hugh Everett came up with this strange idea, one of the real problems with this picture was, why don't we see these superposition states? And there's been a lot of work, even in the last 20-25 years, that has gone a long way toward explaining that. There's something called decoherence that can happen. If you have one of these quantum superposition states, which we believe do exist, actually, because there have been experiments that show that these exist, if it interacts at all with its environment, I mean, even with, you know, one molecule hitting the cat or something, it will actually cause the superposition to break apart into either dead or alive, okay, into those realities. And then in the many worlds picture, those are the threads that continue, but you'll never see an actual cat that's half dead and half alive, even though quantum mechanics allows that as a possibility. All right, you're getting me on thin ice because I haven't done the quantum mechanics experiment, so I'll have to get back to you on that. There are experiments where the existence of the superposition state has been demonstrated fairly clearly, but I have to go do my homework and remember exactly what those are. I've seen them before, and it's just not sticking. Yeah.
It's so the cat's like deadness or aliveness. Predicated on like the 50-50 thing, right? Like it could be, if there were like a 1 in 5 chance the poison like breaks up, and that's like 20% dead for you. So like when I go home for spring break, like before I open the door to my parents' house, like my dad's like 1 in 1 million dead or whatever, a heart attack or something like that. Would that also be true? Or like whatever the odds are of him having died of a heart attack like before.
Yeah.
So is there like a bright line where you draw, like, you know, because there's like a 1 in like 4 zillion chance that, like, the universe has been silent, it's like silently consumed while we're in the room. So like the universe right now is like 1 in 1 zillion, you know, not existing anymore outside of this room.
Okay, these are all great questions. So what happens now with if we go with this many worlds picture, things get pretty bizarre very quick, because we are surrounded by quantum processes. Right, and of course, many of these processes are not binary, but they are many possibilities. So yes, you're sort of creating these threads of reality every time you have this quantum process according to the probability distribution. But of course, you have umpteen quadrillion of those things happening all at once. So what do we have here? So it's not so much that you get a thread of reality and a thread of reality in this picture. It's more like you have a continuum of possibilities, okay? And all possibilities happen within this mini-worlds multiverse, all right? And by a continuum, I mean, suppose we have this nucleus and it decays. At the very moment that it decays, everything else in the universe is the same. So these two threads are very similar right at the start. Then they may differ in time, things that may happen here that are different from here, but initially they're pretty close together, right? So in a sense, you can think of this continuum of possibilities that happens where you have, let's say we had two nuclei, okay? And in one, this one has a 50-50 chance of going, this one has a 50-50 chance of going. This one goes, okay? Now you get two threads, one where this one, I'm sorry. So we have two threads, one where this didn't decay and you have this nucleus, one where this did decay and you have this nucleus, one where this didn't decay and this one decayed, one where this one did decay and that one decayed. So now we sort of have these four threads. So suppose this one, let's imagine they're linear, okay, so that we create this one later. So this one goes, so we sort of have these two threads, and now we put this one, which either decays or doesn't, so you'll get a splitting, and so in time you get these threads sort of diverging in what the universe is like, as near as I can tell, all within this greater quantum mechanical wave function. So we have basically this infinite dimensional wave function which contains within it all of these threads of reality where anything that could happen basically did happen or does happen quantum mechanically. And it's not like you can count them because there's this fine continuum of possibilities. It's almost nonsensical to even ask how many universes are there in this picture, because that would be sort of, you know, how many regrets did a murderer have yesterday in prison? I mean, how do you even define that, right? I mean, it's a really murky sort of thing. So I talked a lot about dimensions, I guess. Let me talk a little bit about dimensions. Because these threads are separated, you experience one, you don't see the other. So how is it that they're actually separated? Because they're not necessarily separated in space. Because by this picture, we have a cat, or we have these photons, and the cat's either alive or dead, and you have these two realities in this particular picture, and yet they're in the cat's still in the same space in each of these pictures mathematically. So what happens? So when I say the word dimension, generally you think of spatial dimension, which is how we figure out where things are in the space in which we live. And so we do have a picture, which is that we're in three-dimensional space, and by that I mean it takes three numbers to specify the exact location of an object, right? If you want to know where the corn nuts are at the grocery store, it's which aisle is it on, how far down is it, and which shelf. Okay, and you have to specify all three to know exactly where they are. Yeah.
Time also.
Okay, so time is another dimension in the sense that the corn nuts weren't there yesterday, they are today, they're not tomorrow. So, and in relativity we've seen that these things can get all mixed up, but basically we live in four dimensions. I mean, that's the way to think about it. If I'm doing mathematical description of something like the location of a ball, then mathematically I describe it using four dimensions, okay? X, Y, Z, and time. If I'm describing two balls, I have X1, Y1, Z1, and T1 for where this ball is, and then I might have X2, Y2, Z2, and T2 for where this ball is. If I want to have a mathematical theory that encompasses both these balls, then mathematically I now have basically eight different variables, okay? And so mathematically I would look at that and say it's an eight-dimensional problem. So mathematicians and physicists, mathematicians are very, very, what they mean when they say dimension is sort of what variables do you have to deal with in the problem. And it's a little bit different from what we normally mean when we say dimension. Physicists lie somewhere in the middle. We normally, when we say dimension, we usually mean X, Y, Z, and T. But if you're really talking about variables in a problem, then we may have many, many dimensions. The momentum of the ball might be part of the problem as well. So if that's part of the problem, and you've already seen where that is a little bit because that involves velocity, if I want to really know where the ball is going to be in an hour, I need to know what's the forces on it, I need to know how fast it's going, and as well as I need to know that its position in time right now, and then I evolve it. So the momentum in the X, Y, and Z are another three coordinates. So if you're doing this quantum mechanical calculation of some sort, you actually have it in a mathematical space that has many variables. We call that space Hilbert space. So if you wanted to have a model of our universe, it's basically an infinite dimensional mathematical space, okay? And you can have things that coincide in space, but be separated within this theory by these other variables, these other dimensions, and not be able to see them. I mean, even with four dimensions, you can have that a little bit, right? If you have two things that are separated by time, you can, we're here right now, and some other class may be here in an hour, same space, but we don't see each other because we're separated by that one dimension. So as strange as it may seem, within this theory, you have these threads that can overlap in space and time, but still be separated in terms of these other dimensions of the problem within the Hilbert space. And so these are different threads of reality and according to this weird theory. So is that weird? It's weird enough that I sort of wish I could say, you know, it was made up by a couple of whack jobs and it's out on the internet and people just picked up on it. But that's not what happened. Quantum mechanics really works. It is supported by a vast amount of experimental data. Is this completely settled? The answer is no. People still argue about how we should interpret quantum mechanics. Nobody argues over whether quantum mechanics is a good scientific theory. It is. We may discover someday, and some people still hope this, that we will discover something that underlies quantum mechanics which will give us determinism again, that all this uncertainty crap and probabilities will sort of go away, and that we'll actually be able to understand how we'll understand a deeper theory that we'll realize, oh, if we throw away our knowledge of this, we end up with just probability distributions, which is our state of ignorance, which is where all those poor people were in the 1900s and the early 2000s. Okay, that could, in principle, happen. People are still, I mean, if you take a vote of a room full of physicists, do you really believe in many worlds or Copenhagen? I don't actually know what the numbers are. Max Tegmark thinks it's actually shifted, because they did an informal survey at one point. He thinks it's actually shifted a lot from Copenhagen, which is more or less what I learned when I was in graduate school, more toward many worlds. Yes?
What does it mean that it works, that quantum mechanics works?
It means that I can picture and calculate things and go in the lab and confirm them. So it can give me the distribution of states amongst different atoms. It can give me probabilities that an electron will drop from one orbital to another and emit light of a certain frequency.
So just saying the most likely combination of...
It can calculate the exact probability distributions, and then you can go out and do a million experiments and you'll find it fit exactly those probability distributions.
And they'll get every one of those million right?
Yeah.
In order.
Yeah, I mean, that's not to say there aren't.
How is that possible given that it's just probabilities?
Oh, well, they won't get each one right. All right, what it will get is the probability distribution right. Okay. So within its constraints, it works really well. That's not a trivial statement.
It just seems like it is, because it seems like, you know, it's like just manipulating probabilities.
Well, no, I mean, you're starting, okay, so calculate the probability of seeing, I give you a million hydrogen atoms, and we zap it with current, okay? Calculate the probability and intensities of the different spectral lines that you'll see. It may only be probabilities, but you're starting from ground zero. How do you calculate that? How we do it is we take the physical situation of the hydrogen atom, which is this nucleus and an electron, we pop it into Schrodinger's equation, which is quantum mechanics. It tells you the distributions of the possible states, and given those, the probability that you'll have transitions, and you can actually get the exact frequencies and intensities of that light coming out. So it's not just taking a statistics course. You have to input the physics and then use this Schrodinger's equation in quantum mechanics to actually calculate these weird quantities. And it gets it right. So it is an active area of research, but it is an example of a multiple universe idea that, I guess I have another picture here where the cat goes dead or alive. It's an example of a multiple universe that is inferred from total solid scientific paradigm. Okay, and it is the basis of a lot of science fiction and stuff, right? I mean, when people talk about, most of the time when they're talking about stuff in other dimensions, they're often sort of referring to this picture. There is a lot of confusion out there, and there, I think there's confusion that even confuses these different pictures of things. So, I'm out of time. Sorry. I'll come back to this. Any other questions or comments for today? All right, have a good break. Oh, I have your exams. Sorry. All right, I have them sorted.